As Christine mentioned, we're in a sermon series called The Way of the Cross. It's going to be a four-part sermon series as we kind of follow the trajectory of Christ on his passion towards Golgotha, towards the crucifixion. Last week, Alan kicked us off, and he talked about how Jesus both saves us through a cross and calls us to a cross. And he talked about what does it mean to be called to a cross-shaped life. And I'm going to look at kind of what that does mean for us in some aspects today, but I'm going to do it by kind of getting very literal in terms of talking about the way of the cross and looking at a scene when Jesus is carrying his actual physical cross and Simon of Cyrene has to actually help him carry that cross. So we're going to be looking at one particular verse today. There's this scene of Simon of Cyrene. It happens only in Mark 15:21, one verse. But I think in this one verse is some profound truths about what it looks like to live a cross-shaped life, specifically about how I think Jesus redefines power, how we understand power and weakness as Christians. He kind of redefines the idea of what it means to be a king. The world has an expectation of what a king looks like, but he comes and subverts that. And I think it's worth noting that today is Palm Sunday, and if you don't know, what Palm Sunday commemorates is the triumphal entry into Jerusalem when Jesus kind of has this great moment of fanfare where he comes in on a donkey. It's this very kingly moment, right, where people are cheering. They're saying, you know, Hosanna, blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. There's palm fronds that they lay down at before the donkey. They put their cloaks down. They really expected, you know, this is the king. This is him. He's coming. They were cheering for him. But what's interesting is that clearly he wasn't the sort of king they wanted, because just a few days later, there's this kind of parallel scene where Jesus is once again walking through Jerusalem, but there's no fanfare. People aren't cheering, they're jeering. They're spitting at him, some of the same people who were cheering for him. And so we're going to look at that latter instance today, that parallel. You know, he came in to great fanfare, but then he's going to his cross in this moment of deep shame. He was not the king that they expected him to be. He flips it on its head. What does it mean to be a king? What does it mean to be powerful? So I'm going to read the kind of larger context, Mark 15:16-32. And as I read this passage, I want you to pay attention. There's some really interesting repeated images in this passage that hint at this kind of kingliness, that kind of mock the sort of king Jesus is, who's so different from the worldly expectation of what a king looks like. So turn your Bibles to Mark 15, and I'll start in verse 16. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion, and they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. And here's the verse we're going to focus on. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left, and those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. So did you notice, like, throughout that passage how prevalent were these kind of worldly ideas of power? Verse 16 sets the scene inside the halls of power, the palace, the governor's headquarters. The next verse, 17, talks about Jesus being dressed in a purple cloak and having a crown, but a crown of thorns. Verse 18, they salute him as the King of the Jews. Verse 19, they mock him by bowing down as they would to a king. Verse 26, the inscription on the cross says King of the Jews. And then at the end of the passage I read, there's this kind of interesting series of people saying things like, dude, Jesus, come down. If you're really the king, if you're really powerful, like, save yourself. Come on. Kings save themselves. And yet there he hangs, right? Pathetic, ashamed would-be king. It was so pathetic that Mark even points out that even those who were crucified with him reviled him. That is not the picture of a king, right, that the world expects. And I think Mark is doing this very deliberately. He's wanting to emphasize the way that Jesus, on his path of the cross, is being mocked for his weakness, but in taking his own path to the cross, Jesus is making a mockery of the worldly notions of power. Because as we know, with the resurrection, Jesus actually is the king, right? In defeating sin and death through his resurrection, God disarmed the rulers and authorities, says Colossians 2, and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. And so there's kind of this bigger context of power and weakness, you know, the world, the idea of power, and Christ's weakness. And then in this context, we have verse 21, which says this: "And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross." Now, interestingly, even in this verse, you see power and weakness at play, right? The Roman soldiers compelled a passerby. They were showing their power. This is something that the Romans just did. In Roman occupied Jerusalem, they could do whatever they want. They could literally, like, pluck strangers out of the crowd and force them, compel them to do things like this. So you have power here. But then, of course, we have weakness, right? Jesus is apparently, presumably, so weak from being beaten and scourged that he can't carry the cross on his own. So you have power and weakness even in this verse. So what do we learn from this verse? What do we learn from Simon of Cyrene in this moment of him picking up the cross and helping Jesus bear the weight, the burden of this cross? I think it teaches us important lessons about what Christ-like power looks like in juxtaposition with worldly power. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about 3 points about Christ-like power. And I think this is a timely topic in today's world, and I'm going to unpack some of the ways I think thinking rightly about power as Christians is so important in today's world. So the first point I want to make is that Christ-like power isn't about surviving or protecting yourself. You know, we live in a world where I think power is understood in terms of protecting yourself. It is understood in terms of survival. There's this sort of Darwinian notion of survival of the fittest, right, that comes from kind of the animal kingdom. If you're strong, you use your strength to your advantage. You kind of power your way to survive. You do everything you can to eliminate threats to your survival. This is how nature understands power. I don't know if you guys have seen Planet Earth. Kira and I are watching this on Netflix now, and we're obsessed. It's just so compelling. But some of the most compelling and fun moments in the show are when two animals are, like, duking it out, battling to the death for one of their survival. One of them's going to win, one of them's going to lose. We saw one last night where it was, like, in the Amazon, it was, like, a panther and an alligator, like, fighting. And then there was a lion and a giraffe, which was crazy. But, you know, it's fun to watch because it's so vicious. It's the animal instinct of survival butting up against each other. And I think this is how we as humans actually, if we're honest with ourselves in our own flesh, we're products of nature, we also understand power this way. I think we fight tooth and nail to keep our power, to maintain our status, even if it costs other people. You know, I think politics is kind of like the easy example of this, unfortunately. Like, politicians have attained this power, they've attained this status, and so they do everything they can to maintain it, right? So you see all these politicians, anytime there's, like, a scandal that comes around, anytime someone accuses them of something, threatens their power and their status, they react by getting rid of the weaker person, getting rid of the accuser, discrediting them. That's how power maintains itself in the worldly approach to power. You do everything you can to maintain your status and your power. And, you know, I think Christians, we are unfortunately very tempted as well to look at power this way. I think the temptation in today's world is huge to view power through this kind of worldly lens of self-preservation, because, you know, we might see threats on the horizon, persecution. We might see our status as Christians, our reputation slipping away a bit. And I think when you see that happening, your reaction in the worldly sense is to grab hold of power and to want to get rid of the opponents, to silence the enemy, destroy the enemy. But I want to suggest to you that this is not the way of Jesus. This is not the picture of power that we see in this passage. You know, Jesus could have chosen the path of self-preservation. He could have. He could have, you know, with Pilate, for example, he could have, like, had this negotiation with Pilate, and he could have been like, you know, Pilate, let's make a deal. If you protect me, if you keep me from, you know, the cross, like, I'll make it worth your while. I'll be your liaison to the Jews. I'll help you connect with them and pacify them, and I'll be your most trusted faith-based advisor, we could say. You know, Jesus could have done that, but he didn't. He didn't compromise his mission for the sake of survival. He chose sacrifice instead. And that's what Christ-like power looks like. One of the interesting things about this passage that, as I was digging into it this week, that is kind of really interesting to notice is that Simon of Cyrene's name is Simon, okay? But it isn't the Simon that you would expect to be there at Jesus's, you know, side, helping him in his moment of weakness. Who would we expect to be there? Simon Peter, right? The right-hand man of Jesus, but he's nowhere to be found. He's denied Jesus. He's gone the route of self-preservation. He didn't want to be associated with this whole, you know, bad thing that was going down. But Simon of Cyrene, this random Simon, is there. Charles Spurgeon notes that this passage is a, quote, silent but strong rebuke to Simon Peter. Where was Simon Peter? He was too afraid. He was too self-interested to be associated with Jesus in this moment. He was too driven by the worldly view of power as self-protection. And Simon of Cyrene was there kind of embodying this Christ-like view of power as self-sacrifice. You know, the parallel of Simon of Cyrene in Mark 15 back to Mark 8 is worth noting because Alan preached on Mark 8 last week. And just to remind you what happened in that kind of pivotal turning point moment in the book of Mark is Jesus tells his disciples in kind of a way that shocks them. He says, look, I'm going to have to suffer. And in fact, I'm going to die. And Peter, Simon Peter, does not like this one bit. And in fact, he rebukes Jesus for even suggesting it. And then you have that funny moment where Jesus says, get behind me, Satan, you know. And then Jesus says, he says this, which is pivotal. He says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Simon probably didn't like hearing this. Simon Peter didn't like hearing this. And so here we are in Mark 15 now, where that idea of take up your cross and follow me is being lived out for the first time by Simon of Cyrene, not Simon Peter. Simon Peter wasn't willing to do that. That was too costly. Simon of Cyrene is willing to do it. So I want to ask us today, which Simon will you be? In the moments of testing, in the moments of weakness and persecution, when things get hard, if they get hard for you as a Christian, will you take the path of Simon Peter and want to protect yourself and disassociate yourself from Jesus? Or will you take the path, the costlier path, that Simon of Cyrene takes? You know, in this moment for Simon of Cyrene, he's compelled to do it, but I'm sure he was so afraid. He didn't know what was going to happen. Like, for all he knew, the Romans would kill him as well with Jesus, or bearing the cross would injure him. You know, it probably did. But the irony is, what a privilege it ended up being for Simon of Cyrene to be plucked from obscurity into this moment that we're talking about in Brea, California, 2,000 years ago. We know Simon of Cyrene by name, and probably millions of other Christians and other churches today are talking about this guy, Simon of Cyrene. There's paintings of him everywhere in churches. And by entering into the suffering of Christ, by carrying his cross, Simon is profoundly dignified. And that's the second point that I want to make about what Christ-like power is. Christ-like power is about dignifying weakness. You know, in this moment, Simon of Cyrene's whole life is changed. You know, Simon of Cyrene, the Cyrene part is Libya. That was where Cyrene was, North Africa. So You know, Simon was likely a man of color. It's possible he was Jewish. There was a sizable Jewish population in North Africa. Some scholars think he was in Jerusalem on pilgrimage for Passover. But the interesting thing in this verse that kind of made me dig into it a little more is why does Mark mention Simon's sons, Alexander and Rufus? Have you ever wondered about that? Like, it seems like an extraneous, unnecessary bit of information. But he says, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Why include that detail? Well, scholars think that it was probably because they were known by the recipients of this letter. So Mark was writing to the church in Rome. So clearly by mentioning Alexander and Rufus, his readers in Rome would have known them. So they must have become prominent members in the church in Rome. Also, in Romans 16, Paul mentions Rufus and says, Rufus's mother was like a mother to me. So this family, Simon's wife, Simon of Cyrene's wife and the mother of Rufus, and these sons, Alexander and Rufus, clearly they became like leaders in the church, prominent members of the church. And all because of this moment when Simon of Cyrene was plucked out of obscurity. His fortune, his legacy, everything changed in this moment. He took on a new status in that moment. And here's the thing. He took on a new status not because Christ gave him a crown, but because Christ gave him a cross, his cross. And that's the invitation to all of us. Jesus invites us not to great heights of worldly power and you know, privilege. He invites us to suffer with him, to follow him, to join him in the way of the cross, which is a way of dignity, right? Weakness is dignified in the kingdom of God. Throughout the New Testament, Paul really hits this point a lot because it was so countercultural. Like we've already seen how Simon Peter didn't really like this idea. He didn't get it. The kingdom of God elevates weakness. So Paul really hits this a lot. In Philippians 3:10, he talks about his desire to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and his desire to share in his sufferings, becoming like him in death. So this means that in God's kingdom, like, you know, we have to celebrate the power of the resurrection, right? The victory, the good times, but we also need to share in Christ's sufferings. We can't neglect that part of it. The path of the cross is not just a path to victory all the time. It's about becoming like Christ in suffering, in death. So all of this means that in God's kingdom, there's this regal, royal, beautiful dignity to weakness. And this is so countercultural in today's world, in this kind of Darwinian dog-eat-dog world that values the strong, the winners, the beautiful people. But look what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1:27. He says, God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. It's a beautiful idea. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. What does that mean for us practically? I think it's important that we try to think about this idea in practical terms in today's world. Something I've been thinking about is that we need to view the weak in our midst, not with kind of tolerance or even just pity, but we need to view them as dignified, beautiful people that can teach us things. We need to learn from them. You know, this is why in the Christian tradition, there's such a tradition of valuing, having compassion for, you know, the unborn, the sick, the leper, the immigrant, the refugee, the orphan, the homeless person, the disabled person. You know, worldly power sees these groups as, you know, these weaker people as inconveniences, perhaps, as problems that we need to solve as a society. We don't know what to do with them. At best, worldly power kind of looks at them as objects of pity that we should have compassion on, but mostly out of pity. Christ-like power doesn't see these people in that way. Christ-like power sees them as beloved, as worthy of great honor, as image bearers of God. This last week was on March 21st, Wednesday, was World Down Syndrome Day. This wonderful day of honoring and dignifying the Down Syndrome community, people who have Down Syndrome. I think this is something we as Christ followers should celebrate and participate in, because Our society today sadly does not dignify people with disabilities. A really kind of stark kind of example of this is the fact that because of prenatal screening tests, that technology allows women who are pregnant to be able to screen for things like Down syndrome, what's happening in Europe and America is less and less babies are born with Down syndrome. They're disappearing from our society because they're being gotten rid of before they're even born. There was a column in the Washington Post recently with the headline, "I would have aborted a fetus with Down syndrome." And in the article, the author says this, and she talks about the life-altering nature of parenting a disabled child, which is true. It is life-altering. She says, "Most children with Down syndrome have mild to moderate cognitive impairment with limited capacity for independent living and financial security. Down syndrome is life-altering for the entire family." And then she says this, "I'm going to be blunt here. That was not the child I wanted." That was not the child I wanted. I think that's the perfect example of a worldly approach to power. It's not about inherent dignity in anyone. It's about what they do for me or don't do for me, how inconvenient or convenient they are. It's about discarding that which doesn't help me in my own kind of flourishing, getting rid of anything that's a threat or an inconvenience. I think as Christians, we need to be very careful that we don't follow that path in the way we look at weakness. We need to have a countercultural, Christ-like view of dignifying weakness, valuing it. I saw a beautiful example of this a few weeks ago in a documentary called Summer in the Forest, which is about a Catholic humanitarian named Jean Vanier. I think he's Canadian. But in the 60s, he started these communities in France for people with disabilities. And there are these beautiful communities where people with disabilities would live in community. They would have beautiful relationships with one another, and they'd each have little jobs and things that they could produce. And this documentary is just, it was so encouraging to see Jean Vanier, who's 87 years old, living among these people. Just the way he looked at them and talked with them was so instructive in terms of what it looks like to have the kind of gaze of Jesus and looking at people with disabilities. And in the documentary, he says this about the people with disabilities in his community. He says, "They are not seeking power. They're seeking friendship. They have taught me about freedom and foolishness. The weak are the foolish. They have been chosen to confound the wise and the powerful. The weak lead us to reality, whereas the so-called wise and powerful lead us to ideologies." I think this is such a challenge to us as Christians. We need to see weakness as a teacher. What does it teach us? It teaches us, for one thing, that we need help. We can't do it on our own. We need help from beyond ourselves. This is what we're talking about in this verse today. Christ himself needed help. Paul, in 2 Corinthians, he writes this about weakness. He says, "For the sake of Christ, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities, for when I am weak, then I am strong." So you see how Jesus like reframes weakness. He flips it on its head. He turns weakness into strength. God is glorified. Christ's power is shown. It's made known to the world when we're honest about our weaknesses. And this is the third point that I want to make about Christ-like power. It's about admitting our weaknesses and bearing one another's burdens. You know, one of the big like values in American culture is self-reliance, right? We love the myth of the self-made man. Pull yourself up from your bootstraps, you know, rise on your own merits, become something, make something of yourself. We love this idea. We celebrate people who have been successful, who have come from nothing and become, you know, the leaders, the powerful in our world. We don't celebrate weakness in terms of people who just kind of stay at the bottom rung on the ladder. We don't really celebrate that. That's not the myth that America loves. And, you know, I fight against this too. I'm a product of American culture. I'm an American male. Like, so I'm driven. Like, I am driven to succeed. I personally have a high value of achievement and productivity. And I was raised in a family, in a context where you didn't really talk about weakness. It was all about achievement, you know, making something of your life. And I've pressured myself to do that. And I also have a personality that's, I'm kind of wired to not ask for help. I like to just get things done myself. It's too distracting to ask other people to help. I don't delegate well. But I've seen this, it can all fall apart, right? When you have this approach, when you don't admit weakness, when you just want to get it done yourself, it can all add up and you can break. And, you know, I broke a little bit this last fall. I started a new job, a really taxing, really intense new job after 9 years of working at Biola. And so that transition was super tough. I had a book that came out in September, and I was traveling a ton on kind of the book tour. So there was a lot going on, and, you know, I like had breaking point moments. Kira can tell you, like, she had never seen this from me in our 5 years of marriage, but some nights I would just literally like randomly burst into tears because it was all too much. And we would do things like holding time. I don't know if anyone went to the Milan and Kay Yurkovich marriage session, you know what I'm talking about with holding time. But it's this thing where, you know, they instruct couples that, you know, to show, you know, it's okay for one member of the marriage to be weak and to just need to receive compassion. And so they instruct couples to have periodic holding time where you lay in their lap on a couch and they just kind of pet you and like and look at you. So there was a lot of holding time for us this fall, and it was mostly me being held by Kira. Sometimes I hold her, but recently it's mostly been me being held. But the way of Jesus is not having it all together. The way of Jesus is asking for help, being upfront about our weaknesses, bearing one another's burdens. You know, Paul in Galatians 6, verse 2 says this, "Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ." Being obedient to the way of Jesus is bearing one another's burdens, kind of showing the world that we're not these powerful, self-reliant people. We need help. We can't do it on our own. And Christ himself demonstrates it, right? This verse that we're looking at today is a beautiful model of Christ himself doing this. He is God, right? He shouldn't need help, but he does. He can't carry the cross on his own. The burden is too great. And so he asks for help. Simon of Cyrene helps bear his burden. So if Christ can't do it on his own, you know, we too need to be willing to ask for help. I was in D.C. this week, Washington, D.C., for a few days, and I was in the subway, and I was, you know how sometimes there's buskers, people like random musicians who have a guitar case open and they're, you know, singing. There was three guys, a trio, kind of like a barbershop quartet, singing the song Lean on Me. And it just struck me, like, this is just too perfect. I'm speaking on power and weakness, and here's these guys singing Lean on Me. And I just want to read some of the lyrics of the song. If you're familiar with it, you know. I think it's so perfect to this idea of bearing one another's burdens. Lean on me when you're not strong. I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on. For it won't be long till I'm going to need somebody to lean on. And here's a really instructive verse. Please swallow your pride. If I have things you need to borrow, for no one can fill those of your needs that you won't let show. And, you know, it struck me, here we are below ground in Washington, D.C. You know, above ground is the halls of power, right? Above ground is worldly power, what I was talking about earlier, people who will do anything they can to maintain their power and status. And, you know, above ground in D.C., you don't see a lot of open talk about weakness. You know, politicians are never giving press conferences about their weaknesses, rarely, unless they're absolutely forced to. But here we are below ground where the common people are riding the subway, and there's these people singing Lean on Me, and it was just such a beautiful moment of reminding me this is what the Christ-like view of power and weakness is. Bear one another's burdens. Lean on me if you're not strong. And we're all not strong in moments, and we need to be honest about that. So I just want to challenge us today as a community, as life groups, let's be people who are not too prideful to let people into our weaknesses, to share our burdens, to ask people, hey, can you carry this burden for me? Can you help me in this moment? It's countercultural in a self-reliant American culture, but we need to model the way of Jesus in asking for help. And on the receiving end, we shouldn't be too busy in this busy, kind of hyperactive age, we shouldn't be too busy that we can't inconvenience ourselves to carry the burdens of other people. So it goes both ways. We need to be willing, less, not too prideful that we can't share our burdens, and not too busy or apathetic that we can't step in to be the helpers. There was a beautiful example of this in our life group recently. One of our dear members of our life group, Rachel Ferris, some of you know, she had a random kind of unforeseen major surgery a few weeks ago. When Kira and I heard, we, as life group leaders, it threw us, and we were deeply distressed for her. So we quickly alerted our life group. We went to the hospital immediately after she had the surgery, prayed for her, were just with her. But it was so powerful to see how our life group, like, rallied together to bear her burdens in this moment. You know, I think probably half of our life group went to the hospital to be there with her, to pray for her. Many of them sent flowers. And then her birthday was a few days later. Like, so she's having a bad week, like having surgery, and it's her birthday. So as a life group, we were like, you know, we need to just bless her immensely on this birthday. So we gathered a lot of cards together, and we actually took up a collection. We were like, you know, she's going to be out of work for some days. We don't know how long. There's going to be a financial cost to this. So let's just take up a collection, give what you can give, and let's bless her financially. This is what Christians throughout Christian history have done. They've taken up collections for one another. And we did that, and I was blown away by how much was given. It was just a beautiful picture of sacrificing to bear one another's burdens. So I just challenge you guys, you know, in your life group, I guarantee in any given life group right now, there's someone who probably has a burden that they could use help carrying. It isn't always as big and dramatic as a major surgery. Sometimes it's small, but everyone has burdens that need to be carried, and we need to be people in our life groups that are talking about this, that are openly asking for help. So let's be people where we are open about our weakness, our suffering, and in so doing, we'll grow closer together. That's the thing about vulnerability and bearing one another's burdens. It binds us together in a beautiful way. But not only does it bind us together in an intimate way, but in being open about weakness, it deepens our own intimacy with Jesus. Because Jesus is a God who can sympathize with us in our weakness, right? We have a God who can relate to us on that level of weakness and suffering. And as we begin this week, as we look to the cross on Friday, on Good Friday, we need to be thinking about this is a God who relates to us on the level of suffering, on weakness. This is rare. There's no other God like this, like in world religions. There's nothing like this. Christian Wiman is a poet that I like. He's an author, and he has a memoir called My Bright Abyss. And he, when he wrote this book, he was struggling in his own faith. He was having doubts. He was wrestling with, you know, how can God exist when there's so much suffering in the world, the problem of suffering, the problem of evil, all of that. So he was going through doubts in his own faith, and he was struggling with cancer. It was a dark time. And yet he retained his faith. And I just want to read a quote that kind of illustrates why, for him, the weakness and the suffering of Christ was the reason why he maintained his faith. He says this: "I am a Christian because of that moment on the cross when Jesus, drinking the very dregs of human bitterness, cries out, 'My God, why hast thou forsaken me?' He felt human destitution to its absolute degree." And here it is. The point is, God is with us, not beyond us in suffering. God is with us, not beyond us in suffering. There's no other God like this. Jesus is unique among world religions in that he meets us in our weakness and suffering. You may be here today and you might be thinking, you know, I'm too broken. I'm too much damaged goods. You know, I've suffered too much for religion. I'm not going to be a good fit for Christianity or any religion. I'm too broken. Or maybe you're here and you're having those doubts about how can religion be true? How can there be a God when there's so much bleak, unexplainable suffering in the world? I just want to remind you that Christianity is about worshiping a God who is not beyond us in suffering. Every amount of agony that has been felt by anyone in this world, he felt as well on the cross. He's not unfamiliar with the pain and the brutality and the agony of this world. So he's a God that can relate to us in this suffering. Hebrews 4:15 says, "We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses."